Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today.
Chris Inglis is our nation's first national cyber director. He is a career officer of the National Security Agency, where he spent more than half a decade as the deputy director. I just talked with Chris at an event at the Michael V. Hayden Center at the Schar School at George Mason University. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm going to dig right in, Chris, and I want to start with the cyber threat facing the nation. You've said publicly that, and I want to quote here, the threat is greater than I can ever remember. And I'm wondering what led you to say that. I'm wondering what the context around that is. You know, is it because we're more vulnerable? Is it because the number of adversaries are growing? Is it because they're getting more sophisticated? Is it because they're getting more aggressive? Is it all of that stuff, or is it something else? You know, what does the threat landscape look like to you?
Yeah, in a phrase, it's all of that. I think we first begin with what is our dependence on what we, most of us, think of as the internet. What I describe as digital infrastructure, we have a massive dependence, whether it's for the conduct of our personal lives, our business lives, our national security. Everything we do is fundamentally dependent upon that, to include a broad range of critical functions, critical to health, safety, life. Second, having created that dependence over many, many years, transgressors, whether they're criminals or geopolitical foes, have realized that dependence, and they're increasingly using that to hold us at risk. And in recent years, and I think that there was an inflection point in about 2017, what we've seen is that those transgressors, criminals to nation states, they're brazen, across anybody's definition of a red line. They're indiscriminate. You don't need to be the target to be the victim. And they're impactful, having borderline existential effects on the conduct of national security functions, critical functions, and the conduct of our daily lives. We're not resilient and robust against that. We don't have the basic resilience and robustness in technology, people, or for that matter, doctrine, who is accountable for what, such that we can simply look the other way and assume that they simply can't hurt us. We don't actually defend these systems as a collaborative endeavor, such that they have to beat all of us to beat one of us. They can pick us off one at a time. And we really don't have a good range of remedies to align actions to consequences. So in all of those facets, we're falling further behind. It's not to say we don't have some very talented people and we don't have some really great technology, but we're not really joined up to solve this problem in a way that's required. And a premise in the job that I have is we need to rethink, how do we actually make it such that if you're a transgressor, you got to beat all of us to beat one of us. We have not done that to date, and therefore we're falling further behind.
Are ransomware attacks the biggest chunk of the attacks that we see?
I think they're the most notorious, to be sure. I'm not sure that I could say with confidence that in quantity, they're the most numerous. But they are a symptom of the larger problem, which is the ecosystem within which they operate essentially has low cost of entry, a set of transgressors, criminals in most cases, but some nation states, who can syndicate, who can collaborate to find someone who might find a weakness in a system of interest, someone that they could sell that to who would then prosecute that entry into that system, someone who might then take over, it's a business, who might then take over to actually effect the actual extortion. They ask for resources to essentially exfiltrate that ill-gotten gain in the form of cryptocurrency, which is hard to track. Many of them operate in safe havens in the Russia, near abroad, or other places where it's hard for the reach of law to find them. And they operate against assets that are at once valuable and poorly defended. Those assets are information that companies find essential to the conduct of their business, or which they kind of hold as information on behalf of others that is personally identifiable information and or health-related information for which they would pay a pretty premium in order to get that back without some further disclosure. It's a perfect storm, long in the making. We're not going to turn that around in a fortnight, but given that I've described a systemic set of weaknesses, the way to address that is to take each of those systemic flaws on and address them one at a time, but in collaboration.
Chris, I wanted to mention that we've learned of at least one tragic instance where a human life, an infant's, was perhaps lost as a result of a ransomware attack in 2019 in a hospital in Alabama. And I know you probably can't comment on the particular case because there's a lawsuit underway regarding the care of the infant. But what I want to ask you is that ransomware attacks aren't just about money, right? I mean, there's human lives at risk here. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement. I think there's another incident that I think is in the public record in Germany where a patient attempted to enter into a hospital. Hospital was down because of a cyber attack. That hospital diverted that patient to another hospital that could properly service them, could coordinate the arrangement of a room and a doctor. And the patient died en route. And so, you know, that is something that I think you could say is directly attributable to a cyber attack. There are untold numbers of deferred appointments because health systems weren't able to efficiently and effectively schedule the activities that were required, that you really can't say how far this problem has gone. But it is not an attack on data or systems or simply an attack on the critical functions that rely on those. It's an attack on health, safety, and confidence that relies on all of the above.
Chris, you mentioned Russia as being a place where organized crime is able to conduct ransomware attacks. You testified that we've not seen yet a decline in attacks originating from Russia since President Biden pressed President Putin on this very issue at the summit in Geneva. Is China another place where organized crime is able to conduct ransomware attacks or not?
It is another place where we see a certain permissiveness in terms of the state, not so much looking the other way, but being tolerant of the criminals who are given harbor there. And so long as they don't annoy or impose some friction or harm on the local economy or the local government, the government tolerates them. As to whether there's a formal connection, a direct connection between the activities of these individuals and a government that would sponsor them or aim them at geopolitical foes, the United States being perhaps a case in point, hard to tell. We lack actually quite a lot of information about the rate of incidents, the seriousness of those incidents, because we don't have a universal reporting mechanism within the United States or many other countries that would say, do we really know the scope of what's happening kind of in this mist and smoke that covers this battlefield?
Chris, do you have a sense of why the Russians and the Chinese and perhaps others don't crack down? Is it because there are political relationships or security relationships, or they just want to do damage to the United States? What's your sense for why they allow this to go on and don't crack down?
So again, without revealing or kind of reverting to classified sources, let me imagine what some of those possibilities are. I think it's a set, it's a range of possibilities. One, they may not be specifically aware that these are happening. They don't actually govern the population the way we might in terms of ensuring that the various actions that kind of harass or kind of bother others, we look into, we pursue, we kind of investigate, and when necessary, we will kind of bring that person to justice. The rule of law is not the same in these places, too. There might be a relationship between the local leadership and these criminals such that there is a profitable arrangement of, we'll look the other way so long as you give us a cut of the proceedings and so long as you do not attack, right, the hand that you're actually being guarded by here. And there might, in some cases, and I have to imagine that this is true in some cases, an illicit or perhaps an explicit but not seen relationship between the government and these criminals such that they can be an artifact of harassment or competition by that nation state against this nation state. I think the Russians under the Gerasimov Doctrine, again, this is very hypothetical, but the Russians under the Gerasimov Doctrine have made it clear that there's no such thing as peace or war. There's just competition. It's all on all the time. And any mechanism that you can bring to bear, whether that's propaganda or harassment below the use of force, is fair game. And they, in many cases, have asserted that they believe we do the same thing. We do not. But their belief perhaps motivates and fuels, you know, their use of these assets in ways that we find somewhere between interesting and befuddling, because we do not have mercenaries in this country who operate on behalf of the government without some very direct kind of contractual relationship such that the government bears the burden of actions taken.
Chris Rob Joyce, who is the director of the cybersecurity director at NSA and who you know well, said recently publicly that almost every nation in the world has a cyber exploitation program, but that more countries are starting to move beyond just cyber intelligence. And it got me thinking about, you know, how you think about international norms here. You know, what's acceptable in cyberspace and what's not, right? Is intelligence collection for national security purposes acceptable? Ransomware not. IP theft not. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so I agree with Rob's perspective on that, both, you know, what he observed and what he describes as a trend, but would say that the first observation is shouldn't be terribly surprising. Most nations have militaries that are armed, right, with various weaponry that can do, can impose violence on others. But the issue isn't whether you have that for legitimate defensive purposes, but rather how you employ that. So Rob's further observation that many of these capabilities that can surveil, or what we might describe in colloquial terms as hack on the internet, many of these are being turned to impose consequences or to do damage. Classically, the term of art would be degrade, disrupt, or damage something on the internet, or more importantly, something that's dependent on that data or those systems or the confidence that's dependent upon that. So some number of nations are, in fact, crossing that line. You've asked about norms. They're actually very solidly defined norms that the United States subscribes to. The Global Group of Experts, sponsored by the United Nations in 2015, came up with a set of norms. They don't have the force of a treaty or a convention, but they generally have been looked at as the reasonable, rational foundation for the expectation one nation should have of another. And they wouldn't surprise, I think, anyone on this forum. Right? They typically would say that no nation has the right in peacetime to hold another nation at risk by holding their critical infrastructure at risk. Therefore, cyber should not be used to hold that critical infrastructure at risk. Any nation seeking the support of another nation in a moment of extremis should expect the support of that nation, and so on and so forth. They're generally very sensible arrangements. They leave off the table the possibility that surveillance using these cyber means may or may not be an appropriate activity to undertake. that would lead us to conclude, and I'll kind of stand in the role of an academic here, that there are circumstances under which that is appropriate, that can be a stabilizing factor, knowing something about the aspirations, expectations, activities of a potential competitor or aggressor allows you to prevent those misunderstandings, prevent crises and conflict. And traditionally for millennia, but at least the life that I've led, we can see that espionage can, when used in proportional ways, be a thoughtful addition to the interaction of nations. And so we have to distinguish between the deny, the great, disrupt, and the use of this to simply understand what's happening in that network of networks.
Yeah. Chris, let's switch to your job. You're the nation's first national cyber director. What are your responsibilities? What are Congress and what is the president holding you accountable for?
And so if you read the law that created this position, it would look like this is yet another power entered into the space, an already crowded space, another role to coordinate, drive, lead, perhaps in a czar-like fashion, call the shots of who does what. We're not interpreting it that way. What we're doing is to say that there are actually quite a lot of capable players and kind of capabilities, right? Whether that's technology or expertise in the form of people, there are already quite a lot of that in space. What's missing is coherence and context and perhaps some complementary action. And so my job principally is to ensure that we are joined up, that the sum of the parts is greater than the arithmetic sum, that the various roles and responsibilities complement one another. One case in point is that there are within the US system kind of what are called sector risk management agencies that have the responsibility from the federal government to have a relationship with a critical sector. So the Department of Energy has a relationship with the energy sector for purposes of peace and tranquility, helping them understand best practices, make themselves resilient and robust, and in a contingency or crisis, be a principal source of support from the government. There are 16 of those for 16 critical sectors. At the same time, the Department of Homeland Security has an organization, and it's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is the on-the-field quarterback operationally responsible for ensuring that all of that done is done in a coherent fashion. My job as the coach, that's the term we use, is to ensure that that's the way it's established, that everyone understands their roles, that those roles are complementary. And when we execute those roles, that they in fact are coherent, and you don't need a PhD in government to understand who is going to do what under what circumstances. I have roles that descend from that of driving public-private collaboration, of doing performance assessments, of actually driving future resilience, because today is mostly about response. We need to get to a point where we're actually preventing these incidents, getting left of event, as it were. All of that adds up to a responsibility I have to make the system better, more coherent, make the performance more efficient and effective, but not to introduce yet another power that's hierarchical in nature into the system.
So Senator King, who was one of the leaders of the Solarian Commission on which you served, said that the National Cyber Director role was at least in part recommended so that there would be, he said, one throat to choke. And I'm wondering if you felt any of that pressure since you've taken this job.
Well, of course I have. So I was on the Hill just yesterday for a 3-hour kind of hearing. And there is an expectation, especially when one looks at the organization chart, the static picture of all of the pieces that are in this space. Natural question is, who on earth is in charge of that? That's a quite natural, quite reasonable question. It turns out it's not that simple. Turns out that when the video gets started, when those begin to operate, much like it is in the physical world, there are kind of lines of effort that are not so much independent of one another, but they don't actually have a hierarchical relationship. They have a horizontal relationship, right? We know what individual police forces do to defend, right? They're kind of part of the situation in the physical world. We know what militias do in the National Guard to help us in times of crisis, whether that's a natural disaster or some civil crisis. We know what the US military does. We know what all of those parties do, and they're concurrent without having a single battle captain that stands at the top of some hierarchy. So I think the right question to ask of this very complicated domain is, do we know who's accountable for what, under what circumstances, and for what purposes? My job is to make sure that we have an answer to each of those lines of effort. And so if you ask who is the on-the-field quarterback that synthesizes everything the government knows and pushes that back out to the largest possible set of beneficiaries, that's CISA. And my job is to make sure that they're set up to succeed in that. Do we know who deals with the energy sector in times of peace and tranquility or in the rise to some contingency or crisis? That's the Department of Energy. My job is to make sure they're set up for that and that those two complement one another. There's, of course, a lot more threads on that map, but my job is to make sure that all of that works and that the system is performing in an optimal fashion.
Chris, you know that some of the commentary about your position is that you don't have the authorities, right, that you need to ensure that you meet your responsibilities. How do you think about that critique?
There's some truth to that. If what you're thinking about is an hierarchical set of authorities where you can direct drive things, even to the point of micromanagement, the law is written in many regards with a view to this is really about coordination. This is about establishing relationships and then allowing those to execute with some degree of accountability to be delegated. The law even begins by saying upon direction of the president, giving the president further authority, right, to determine how else he or she would want to assign that power. Case in point, within the scope of my job, I really am inside cyberspace, ensuring that all the assets that live inside cyberspace are properly prepared, properly assigned, are complementary, and that we execute. But if you're operating outside of cyberspace to try to bring conditions of some sort about inside cyberspace, let's say you're using military powers or diplomatic powers or intelligence powers, a broad range of traditional instruments of national power, that is traditionally the role of the National Security Council. And that is not mine to drive. I'm at that table. I inform that. I'm heavily informed that. But that's in someone else's hands. That's just the way we as a government have almost always kind of conducted our affairs. We want to achieve conditions inside a domain by using other instruments that are outside that domain. National Security Council adjudicates and drives that. And so I'm the same in that regard, is that I'm in the lane of cyber, trying to make sure that as an instrument of power, not the only instrument of power, affected by other instruments of power, I'm doing my part in that lane.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Chris Inglis.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
So, Chris, the building of your office, so the infrastructure bill gave you $21 million, I think, for your office. You've talked about growing your staff to 75 folks. Where are you now in terms of people? And what are you looking for in terms of your staff? And where are you finding them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm going to expand that question just a little bit so that the context is clear. So this position was created in January. It was authorized in January. There wasn't an appropriation in January. I was nominated, confirmed, and showed up for work in July. But the appropriations to essentially fund the positions required and the facilities and the material, those appropriations weren't made until Monday of this week, the week that we're in. So like 2 days ago. So what we've done between July and now, and actually there's a silver lining in this, is we've had to work hard to figure out if we don't have the resources ourselves to hire 75, 80 people, how do we then work with and through others to get the resources, loan-ins, right, what we're called non-reimbursable detailees, to create a sufficiently robust set of team players here. That can begin to coordinate, begin to champion, begin to create the connective tissue that will give additional leverage to the discrete parts that are out there. So I've got 18 people at the moment. All are essentially non-reimbursable detailees, loan-ins from other organizations. And they come from across the gamut of the federal kind of ecosystem, from the intelligence community, from the Department of Energy, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and so on and so forth. It's an impressive group of people with significant experience under their belts, so much so that walking the halls sometime, somebody will say, I recently met, fill in the blank, somebody from your organization, and they ask me, are you with them? Right? It's the other person who carries the reputation. That's cool. That's really good. I love being in an organization where the talent exceeds your own ability to perhaps kind of script something from the top down. But now that we do have the money, we're kind of in the breakout moment. We have defined the outcomes that we're accountable for. We've built relationships. Some of those relationships will be very key. So, for example, the Office of Management and Budget, which traditionally has policy and resourcing authority in this space, cyberspace, their chief information security officer for the entire federal government has been appointed by mutual agreement between me and the director of OMB as my deputy for federal cybersecurity. So we're harmonizing and aligning those roles and responsibilities. But now that we have the resources, the $21 million, we'll find the space necessary to conduct these activities. We'll then begin to hire the people to the tune of 75 or 80 that can build out four broad lines of effort, which I kind of described earlier. I'd be happy to go into details on that.
Chris, do you see yourself as putting together a national cyber strategy or not? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there should be a national cyber strategy. And I like the term, the way you've described that. Neither kind of with a defensive mindset alone or offensive mindset alone, but just what are the aspirations this nation has that we want to achieve in and through cyberspace? It is necessarily a derivative of a national security strategy. So what is it this nation wants to achieve? What things do we hold near and dear? What do we want to perhaps achieve in terms of our own initiative? That is currently being worked through by the National Security Council. The interagency process comes to bear on that. Once that's done, then there'll be a derivative out of that, since cyber is an instrument of power and it's a domain of interest, that would then be able to say, so what's cyber's role in that? And what do we need to do with all instruments of power to ensure that we bring those conditions about in cyberspace? I think there will be not a standalone, but perhaps kind of an appendix that says, here's the cyber play, here's the cyber part. But it has to be part of the whole. I'm then asked, so if you have a cyber strategy, will you have a cybersecurity strategy or a federal cybersecurity strategy or an Eisenhower building cyber strategy? All of those things can be inferred, but it gets dangerous to kind of call them out and create stovepipes of those things in and of themselves. So I think at the moment, we're kind of trying to make sure that we stay holistic in that description.
And your office will put that together, take the lead on that, and I guess there'll be a classified version and also an unclassified version for the public?
Yeah, so back to the conversation. The answer is we'll have a heavy influence on that. But given that the cyber strategy will depend upon the application of all instruments of power to achieve the conditions we desire in cyberspace, and that cyber can affect all instruments of power, all domains of interest, I'm a significant player in that. I don't mean to over or understate my role. I'm not the only player in that. And ultimately, the National Security Council will determine, do we have the right strategy? I think we've left behind the idea that cyber is a domain unto itself, that it's independent of the other domains of interest, that we can somehow determine in a purely symmetric way that what happens in cyberspace should be responded to by cyberspace. That's not true, especially when you have the safe havens that we're kind of encountering that require the application of other instruments of power. Legal remedies, financial remedies, diplomatic remedies.
So, Chris, you've said publicly that a strategy that is overly reliant on indictments and other actions by, say, the Justice Department doesn't do a lot to affect the psychology of hackers who are sitting in, say, Russia. So how do you think about United States actually deterring those folks? How do we do that?
Yeah, that's a great question.
That seems an important part of the strategy going forward.
Yeah, I wish we had 6 hours to talk about it. First, I think that, that I'm confident that this administration and previous administrations, but this one, believes that cyber deterrence is possible. But we have to hedge our expectations. It's not the same thing as what we experienced in the realm of nuclear deterrence. where the game was, we needed to keep the weapon off the field. It was an offense-dominant era, such that when a nuclear weapon showed up, it was game over. You'd lost, right? You know, you abject failure. The cost of entry is too low, such that in cyber, this is an offense-persistent domain. But the game remains the same, which is cyber has, or deterrence has always been focused on changing the decision calculus of a transgressor, not on some absolute sense of whether you can keep the weapon off the field or not. You know, that's unique to one domain. It's not kind of going to work in this one. And where does the change of decision calculus come from? Several places. One is you need to convince them that it's simply not worth the cost. You become a harder target. So deterrence by denial actually has a play in this space. Actually, 80, 90% of what's happened in ransomware is attributable to simple human errors. You can go back through the most notorious events of this year, and in each case you say, but for this very simple kind of single-threaded vulnerability that was traceable to a human action, it wouldn't have happened. It's not to say that the transgressors wouldn't up their game and try and find another way. They would, of course. But we can get rid of a lot of this just by deterrence by denial, complemented by a very proactive defense, meaning these systems can't be made secure. At best, they're defensible. We need to actually defend them. And to my earlier point, you need to defend those in a collaborative manner because they can beat us one at a time if we use only those things we know in our respective stovepipes. But if we combine our insights, our authorities, capabilities, we're a tougher bunch to beat. And then finally, you do need to impose consequences on those that continue to come at, harass, or succeed against you so that denial by or deterrence by cost of position, that's a real and material factor. Of course, classic deterrence theory says that there's also the role for norm setting. We've done that. And there's also a role for entanglement, meaning that let's kind of come up with a like-minded group of nations that creates a bulwark against the kind of folks who would transgress. And let's make sure that to the extent necessary, we entangle ourselves with those transgressors so that they at least understand what we believe is appropriate or inappropriate behavior. And they're more likely if we have some shared activities. We might not agree on everything, but they're more likely if we have some shared activities to not want to hold common interests at risk. That's, of course, a complicated formulation, but it's the sum of all those things that I think creates a change in the decision calculus of a potential transgressor. And I think if we were to give more time and attention to that, we would make a discernible impact on the level of threat that we're experiencing.
Yeah, Chris, you mentioned a key part of that is us defending our systems. And I'm wondering how you think about what's standing in the way of that, right? What's standing in the way of people applying the technology they need to apply and undertaking the behaviors they need to have? Why is this so hard in terms of defending these systems?
I think that's a great question. And I don't want to steal thunder from a question you might ask me later, what keeps me awake at night? But it's in this category, which is what really keeps me awake at night is not kind of the nature of threat that's constituted in the form of either criminals or nation states. What keeps me awake at night is our proactive ambivalence. And by that, I mean that we're generally aware as a society that something is amiss, right? You know, you can't miss this. You can't stand there and watch the news reports and believe that nothing is amiss. Where the proactive ambivalence comes in is we all believe it's somebody else's problem. This is not my problem to solve, right? And so we variously point to the folks that have cyber or IT in their names and say, you need to hold me safe from mistakes or risks that I take, right? That's simply not a tenable proposition. Or we believe that individuals can't make a dent on this, that organizations, small to medium-sized organizations, can't make a dent on this, that only the champions of sufficient heft and size can, or worse, that we can shoot our way out of this, that it's simply a game of if somebody does A to us, then tit for tat, we're going to do B back to them. All of that, I think, is in the realm of we simply don't understand the problem as it is, and we sometimes refuse to acknowledge it for what it is. And I worry about the latter of those more than anything else.
Yeah.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital.
Crow portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Chris, I'd love to get your take a bit on what you see as the proper relationship between the government and the private sector here. Obviously, that's important. And for context, let me just tell the audience something I'm sure you know, that in a recent accounting of the response to the Solar Winds incursion, the president of Microsoft, Brad Smith, actually wrote, and I quote, "It's impossible to avoid the grave conclusion that the sharing of cybersecurity threat intelligence today is even more challenged than it was for terrorist threat information before 9/11. So there's, you know, some pretty strong views out there. So how do you see this? What do you think it should look like, and how do we get there?
Yeah, so that was a comment made circa late 2020. I agree. Contemporaneously, I agree. So let's go back to 9/11 and use that perhaps as an analogy. You and I remember quite clearly that two things that we kind of thought we learned in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was, and I quote General Hayden here, that garrison was not sanctuary, right? That we were held at risk in our kind of our homeland. That's true times 10 in cyberspace. And the second thing I can remember thinking that we learned in the immediate aftermath was we had failed to connect the dots. That actually, in the long arc of our experience, that wasn't really the problem. The problem was we had failed to put our various hunches and inside shards and shreds of information together in a way that we could form the dots, that we could learn something together by combining these authorities in an appropriate and lawful way to discover something that no one institution could discover alone. That's true in cyberspace times 100. And so when kind of various parties, whether it's the person you refer to, other CEOs say, it's really hard, right, to kind of share information, that's only half the problem, right? Sharing information is one thing, but creating insights in a collaborative fashion that no one could find alone, that's another thing. And that's where I think we're really falling short. So you and I well know the nature of what's called the special relationship between the US and the UK. And the real secret sauce there isn't the degree of which sharing will kind of do for exquisite, finely kind of tailored reports. The real magic there is that we collaborate at the lowest possible level to share insights and partial kind of understanding so that we together form kind of analyses that neither one of us could form alone. I'm not giving away the kind of the secret here. That's actually the magic, the miracle of that. So what we're proposing that we do differently to address the concern that you've raised is how do we actually reverse the model for collaboration, which used to be information itself is a form of collaboration. It's not. Information doesn't collaborate. Or that we'll kind of find something that we think is so exquisitely valuable that, of course, it's probably going to be classified or proprietary, that will then work to try to figure out how to sanitize and push it across to the other party. At that point, it's sufficiently denuded of any valuable content or timely kind of timeliness that it's typically not worthwhile. That's what people were reflecting on in 2020. Let's actually figure out how to get together to co-discover, co-mitigate threats that we can only find by saying we need to form dots together. It's not a notional aspiration. Our British counterparts, our Israeli counterparts have both done this. They have different names for those activities than we might assign to them, but they've essentially put private and public sector experts together on a common floor plate, and they've achieved a demonstrable success in trying to figure out what can we discover together for the benefit of all of us, right? So the transgressor needs to fool all of us to get past one of us. or more importantly, to beat all of us, to beat all of us.
So Chris, when you step away from this job in 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, you know, whenever it is, right? What would success look like as the nation's first national cyber director?
I can think of three things at the moment. One, that this organization was known and quantitatively could be assessed as having added value to the ecosystem, the private sector, public sector ecosystem combined, right? That the parts were more effective, that they had greater leverage, greater context with respect to their ability to make the difference that they should. Two, that we had established a culture within the federal government that while it does need to ensure that it regulates and ensures the delivery of critical functions and other activities consistent with law and the expectations of customers, that more often than not, what it did was to proactively generate capacity, insights, capability before the event to aid and abet the kind of improvement of the resilience and robustness of the system and the creation of conditions that essentially got us left of the event. And that finally, third, is that we in the community of nations increasingly saw this as an international kind of challenge, not a national challenge alone, that we saw that the largest possible context is the most appropriate and the most impactful context, which is that we do this among like-minded nations.
That was Chris Inglis. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today. The show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.